From New Hampshire Public Radio, this is Outside In, a show about the natural world and how we use it. I'm Sam Evans Brown. So, a few weeks ago, I invited the Outside In crew over to my house. Producer Taylor Quimby and his son brought Girl Scout cookies.
Tagalongs or the...
I like both. One.
I made some popcorn, which of course makes for great radio sound effects. And we hooked up my laptop to a projector. The thing that we were there for? The debut episode of the BBC's landmark nature documentary, Planet Earth 2.
A snake's eyes aren't very good, but they can detect movement.
If you haven't seen it, the footage is amazing. It is sometimes hard to believe.
I kind of feel like maybe we'll be on a hike someday in some endangered species territory, and you'll just be like, what's that? BBC cameras.
That's my wife, Aubrey. We actually used to have Planet Earth parties back in college when the series first came out.
And there's actually like a BBC cameraman who's been like living in a cave on that cliffside for like 3 years.
This guy's is a rock.
So on this first episode of the new series, Islands, there's this one scene that you might have seen on YouTube.
Cool iguana, go.
There's a beach where little baby marine iguanas are hatching under the sand and poking their heads up.
More babies are hatching.
They look like they're little mohawks. Mm.
They do.
But as soon as they do, they've got to run for it.
Oh my God! Oh my God, they're coming from everywhere.
Because hiding in the nearby rocks are packs of long, thin racer snakes. The iguanas are fast, darting across the rocks and sand as the racer snakes close in, but then, disaster.
Oh no!
One of the baby iguanas gets caught by what looks like at least four snakes, which all start coiling around its body, squeezing it to death.
Oh, oh, they got him.
But then it breaks free.
Get out!
Oh,
yeah! Oh
my God.
Run, little buddy, run.
This is like straight out of an action movie.
This is a horror movie.
There's the intense score, the super close camera angles, the life and death stakes. And part of what makes this drama so compelling is that it's real, right? Or is it? Producer and occasional buzzkill, Taylor Quimby has been working on a story about wildlife films. And after the iguana scene, he had us go back so he could point something out.
Like some of this stuff is totally fake.
What do you mean?
Watch.
Like that right there?
Yeah. None of the sound here is real. That like little pitter-patter where he's running?
Yeah.
Nope.
Yeah, it's the sound of yum.
What do you mean? That's what they sound like?
Yeah.
How dare you try to tarnish the good name of David Attenborough. Watch your mouth, Taylor.
Watch it! So Taylor isn't saying the footage is fake, but he does think that there are certain industry tricks that get used that the audience may not be aware of, like sound effects that are added afterwards.
Sound? Like, is that like an ethical lapse, you know? Like, what do you think about that?
Fake sounds doesn't really bother me. What bothers me is, like, fake scenarios. That bothers me.
I don't know, as long as you're not pairing, like, hippopotamus sounds with iguanas.
It's essentially a part of also what we do, you know? It's like, an instructor told me one time, it's emotional fascism, you know? It's a way to really, like, impart, like, feelings.
What if we looked into this and we found out that iguana scene of that iguana running away was actually, like, eight different iguanas cut together and, like, four of them didn't make it, but all that was cut out?
That would be upsetting. Yeah, that would be upsetting.
Nature documentaries and wildlife films transport us to places in the world that still feel wild. But what if the wilderness they present is staged? What if, in order to capture nature's unvarnished beauty and conflict, filmmakers have to engage in a bit of fakery? Today, Taylor Quimby and I are going to examine how deception is used to enhance the drama of nature documentaries. Some of these stories are clearly a breach of journalistic ethics, but in other cases, some would argue that the ends justify the means. But ultimately, you'll be the judge. And bringing up my mic.
Banter, 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 banter.
So I guess I'll just launch in and start with one of the pioneers of nature films. None other than Walt Disney.
I don't know anything about Walt Disney.
Well, he invented Mickey Mouse.
Yeah.
pretty sure.
Okay, whatever.
In 1948, Disney started a series called True Life Adventures, which started out as a bunch of short wildlife films, but eventually turned into a number of features. There was The Living Desert, The Vanishing Prairie, a movie called Perry, centered around a little forest squirrel.
Aww.
Perry the little turtle squirrel. She's quick as a wink.
Walt Disney set the rules, right? I mean, he was forging new territory back in the early days, in the 40s and 50s.
This is Canadian journalist Bob McEwen.
And I don't think there was anybody paying attention. They just assumed that everything that was presented was as it was purported, which is true to life and nature.
The miracle of mother love, a vital force that even in the savage breast protects the young until their age of helplessness is past.
And these are the movies that popularized what we call the classical style of wildlife films, where the animals are protagonists, and the stories often revolve around coming of age, life cycles, predator prey, the whole wilderness is hard but beautiful motif.
Still between the red fox and his vixen, there is a bond that holds them in a close companionship. So shall they stay through all of life, for this is nature's way.
And stylistically, True Life Adventures also pioneered the sound and feel that we associate with nature documentaries. The deep-voiced narrators, soaring scores, all that stuff. And people loved it.
The documentary feature, the winner is The Vanishing Prairie, Walt Disney.
And then, in 1958, Disney released the Arctic-themed True Life Adventure called White Wilderness, which starred polar bears, oxen, wolves, beluga whales, and lemmings, which are like big hamsters. Or small
guinea pigs.
Rats.
So these are the little creatures that are famous for jumping off of cliffs to their doom.
I asked Bob McEwen if he saw White Wilderness when he was a kid.
Yes. Oh, absolutely. Sunday evenings with Walt Disney in my household and growing up in the 50s in Ottawa, it was family time. We all gathered around the TV as we would have a fire in frontier days, I guess. And nothing was better than the True Life Adventures because you believed you were learning the gospel truth about these creatures. Walt Disney was such a trusted figure. He was like a family member. He was like your grandpa.
The title, True Life Adventures, is really important.
Walt Disney's True Life Adventures, they had, before each of them began, this printed statement on the screen. These films are photographed in their natural settings and are completely authentic, unstaged, and unrehearsed.
Now, Bob was 8 years old when White Wilderness came out. So fast forward 24 years. It's the 80s. Now he's an investigative journalist working with the CBC program The Fifth Estate.
Hard-hitting theme.
Yes, it's very newsy. Anyway, Bob starts working on a story for The Fifth Estate about animal abuse in the movie industry, a nearly hour-long feature called Cruel Camera.
Even Hollywood overreached itself when, for a spectacular sequence in the film Jesse James in 1939, it sent a horse to its death over a cliff.
So the first half of Cruel Camera is really focused on big Hollywood features, especially Westerns, and it's really awful stuff, using tripwires on horses in full gallop to simulate falling in battle. Or in this movie called Heaven's Gate, for example, filmmakers killed and gutted cows so they could use real blood on the actors instead of the fake stuff.
Ugh.
But then Bob turns his attention to nature documentaries and a tip that he got about Disney's now Oscar-winning film at this point, White Wilderness.
One of the cameramen on White Wilderness was a guy named Bill Carrick, who had a farm outside Toronto where he raised animals for nature films. And I remember the moment when I said, "Tell us about the lemmings." And he sort of froze. And then he had this slow grin and he said, "Who told you about that?"
So, the lemming scene. Here's what happens. The film starts out describing this legendary lemming behavior that on some sort of regular cycle, lemmings will commit mass suicide
by rushing into the sea in droves.
So in the film, there are these sweeping shots of the cliffs.
Ahead lies the Arctic shore.
And there's also one camera, and it's got a really funny angle. It's sort of as if you were standing on the edge looking down.
They reach the final precipice.
And you can just see the noses of all these lemmings as they get right up close to the edge, and they're peering over. And then they just start flying off. They just start pouring off the edge of this cliff.
And then there's sort of a postscript in which the narrator says, you know, there are some things it's not given to man to understand in the ways of nature, and this is one of them.
And so is acted out the legend of mass suicide and destruction of a species, it would seem to be. Except that nature, in her infinite wisdom, has spared a few.
When we did our investigation, we realized there were a few problems with this. One, it wasn't shot next to the Arctic Ocean, as it said. The body of water in White Wilderness is the Bow River in southern Alberta. Number two, there are no lemmings in southern Alberta, so they had to go to Churchill, Manitoba, up in the Arctic, and get Inuit kids to bag lemmings for them, and they flew them down to Canmore, Alberta, next to the Bow River.
Worst of all is that the whole lemming legend that they set out to film, this behavior of mass suicide, is total bull.
It's a myth. It doesn't happen in nature. So to address that issue, they apparently built a kind of turntable thing, and it was placed just over these cliffs and off camera. And they had whoever was the lemming wrangler pour bags of lemmings onto the turntable, which would then fling them out into the air and over the cliffs. Some of them would actually strike the cliffs, and you could tell they didn't want to go. They were backpedaling like crazy. But all of them eventually, whether they were flung out into the water or whether they slid off the cliff into the water, ended up in the water.
Yeah. So I think it's safe to say that there's a lot of problems here.
Number one, flinging lemmings off cliffs.
But, I mean, honestly, though, there's actually so many issues, it's hard to figure out what is sort of the worst ethical violation. I mean, I think killing the animals that you're documenting is probably the worst. Also, just having complete made-up factual errors.
Right. I mean, like, this is a myth that Disney didn't create, but they brought it to the masses. I mean, this is, like, part of our language now. Like, when you call someone a lemming, it's because of this scene in this documentary. It's like someone who does something blindly and without thinking, even though it's bad for them. That's what a lemming means in our pop culture because we've been deceived.
I guess the other thing that really stuck out to me as being especially problematic was that they didn't just do all of this stuff and sort of try to hide it. They specifically said that it was real.
Trust was part of their brand.
You want nature filmmakers to be the real deal. You want them to go out there and wait for the snow leopard in the Himalayas for 3 months, you know? I mean, that's what you want them to be. And to think that people are paying to cut corners, it doesn't conform to my romantic sensibility.
I'm curious, you know, in your productions, do you ever confront this problem? I mean, I'm kind of curious, where do you draw the line? Are you willing to use, like, sound effects that weren't recorded at a scene? I mean, do you have to deal with this yourself?
Yeah. Yes. We're bound by a very comprehensive set of standards and practices at the CBC. But I was working on Cruel Camera, and then we went to Prince Edward Island, little Canadian province, and it was a show that was taking place mostly in the springtime. And the day we were there, and we were only there for one day, there was a raging blizzard. It was a spring blizzard, so we couldn't shoot the stand-ups, the pieces to camera that would fit with our piece, the springtime piece. So I found myself, at the same time as I was criticizing Disney, standing in a park outside Toronto on a spring day, if not stating, certainly strongly implying that I was in Prince Edward Island. And yes, that gave me pause.
Okay, so killing lemmings and perpetuating a lie to the point that it makes its way into our lexicon, not super awesome.
Some ethical lines definitely cross there.
Now let's fast forward to our second example of deception in a nature film. In this case, the documentary comes from 1997, Whales, An Unforgettable Journey.
Now, this is one of those IMAX movies that plays in museums around the country. It's narrated by
none other than Captain Picard.
Who has a real name. He is an actor.
Yes, Patrick Stewart.
Sir Patrick Stewart.
It's a place as alien as space. A fluid world of darkness and cold and extraordinary forms of life.
And I should say that in the four decades between White Wilderness and this movie about whales, a lot has changed. The outright animal murder is, for the most part, gone, or at least not easily found out. And there is definitely a greater emphasis on scientific accuracy. But budgets are actually quite a bit smaller than they used to be in the True Life Adventure days. And there are definitely some real problems inside the industry.
The animals are sought after and harassed in order to get the shots.
This is Chris Palmer, a documentarian and author of the salacious-sounding Confessions of a Wildlife Filmmaker. He thinks that people in his line of work should have some sort of ethics training.
And often, these are very small crews, sometimes just husbands and wives. And when you're out there in the field on your own, against a deadline, the money's running out, the weather is looking inclement, and you only have a two-day, three days left, it's very tempting to behave in an inappropriate way and harass animals in order to get the shots that your executive producer back in a comfortable office in New York City is desperate to get.
Now, Chris was one of the producers on Whales, An Unforgettable Journey, which isn't quite the classical wildlife documentary style we described earlier. This is one of those documentaries where we actually see the human scientists who are researching and interacting with these whales.
Physical contact with their mothers is very important to the babies. As an observer, my own relationship varies from whale to whale. Their natures often seem as diverse as human personalities.
So in the film, two whales are positioned as the protagonists of the story.
And we call them Misty and Echo. Misty and Echo. Misty was the mother. Echo was the calf. And we
see the divers out there with them. You see them swimming together, nuzzling.
Eye to eye, across the gulf between species.
And when it comes time for them to migrate, it's this big, long journey. And the film ups the tension by wondering whether our brave mother whale and her calf will survive.
Will they get caught in fishing nets? Will they collide with ships? Will they be predated on by killer whales and so on, all the threats that they face in the sea?
Now, finally, we get to the end of the film, and they really draw out the suspense. There's other whales popping up all around, but Misty and Echo are nowhere to be seen. And then...
Then, the moment they had hoped for. By sheer luck, they spot a calf with familiar markings. It's Echo.
Echo!
Echo!
And Misty is with her.
The music is euphoric and moving, and we see that, yes, Misty and Echo arrive in Alaska after this vast journey.
They've made it, unharmed.
Well, of course, you know this. You know what I'm going to say before I even get there. That wasn't actually Misty and Echo. It's almost virtually impossible to see a mother and calf leaving and then finding them at the end of their journey, the same animals. So we made that up. The audience was misled.
I mean, the thing that kills me is when they say, they see a whale with a familiar marking. They didn't just say, like, it's Misty and Echo. Like, they made up the details.
It's a familiar marking in that all whales have markings that are somewhat similar and therefore kind of familiar.
Yeah. Do you think Patrick Stewart knew?
He's
so trustworthy.
He's a savvy guy. I bet he suspected.
Okay, but what do you think about this strategy? Increasing the sympathy of the audience for the characters or the animals by using a fake narrative?
Well, I would say sure, it's a fake narrative, but only kinda, right? Because the narrative of the migration is true. Like, Misty and Echo made it, probably. They just didn't find them.
Oh, I don't know.
The part that's not true is the filmmakers finding the whales at the end. It's true that the whales do this amazing migration every year, and that's the story they're trying to tell.
I guess I would just say that I don't think you need to give them names and personalities in order to tell that story. But anyway, before we move on, I should point out that even Chris is on the fence about whether or not the Misty and Echo thing is problematic.
A lot of people would think that's unacceptable. We didn't tell the truth. We deceived the audience. I would say it's a kind of, it's, you know, it, I would say that In retrospect, I wouldn't do it again, but it's not that bad of an ethics violation. But I have to say, a lot of people would say that is not acceptable.
Yeah, I'm in the latter category, the not acceptable category. So we still have a couple more examples of nature documentary deception left. And this next one, I'm pretty sure that you and I, Taylor, we're guilty of this one. And that's coming up right after a break. And that is called the cliffhanger. It's not a great cliffhanger. Welcome back to Outside In. I'm Sam Evans Brown. I'm here with producer Taylor Quimby, and today we've been talking about deception and nature documentaries. Thus far, we've heard about some serious ethical lapses, killing animals, bad science, but now we're moving on to some more ambiguous territory.
If there's a monkey jumping from one tree to another, right, and it lands on the branch.
And for this next type of deception, we're not using any specific scene as an example.
You know, little bit of after effect there of the leaves continuing.
Because you can pretty much guarantee that these tricks are used in just about every nature documentary you've ever seen.
So you've got a big savanna and there's a wildfire, right? This is just grass, so.
Oh, wow. So what we're talking about here is sound editing. Adding or enhancing video with sound that wasn't actually recorded at the same time, or in some cases was created in a studio.
Well, when you're shooting slow motion, if you're actually capturing in slow motion or time lapse, there's no sound recorded. So you have to put something in there if you're going to have a sound there. Otherwise, just rely on the composer to have a good score in that area, I suppose.
This is Frank Schuring, sound editor and mixer and president of Capital Post Production. He actually did a bunch of the post-production sound work on the first Planet Earth series way back when. And my conversation with Frank is what clued me in to the fact that iguana snake scene on Planet Earth 2 wasn't entirely above board.
Watch your mouth, Taylor.
You watch it!
Because the chase was in slow motion, but the sounds that were paired with the chase, the pitter-patter of the iguana's feet, the hissing, snaky sounds, those are clearly not in slow motion, so at the very least, they were recorded separately and added.
We did get in touch with one of the producers of that first episode of Planet Earth 2 over email, and she did say they do everything they can to record good sound in the field, and that a lot of what you hear are real snake or iguana or beach sounds, but not everything.
If you're doing a show about lions, you can record them doing the roars because their roars travel like miles, you know, but you may not hear the lion walking through the grass or, you know, snuggling up with a cub or something like that. And even though I guess if you were brave enough or stupid enough, you could get pretty close with the microphone, it may be noisy or something like that. And so there are times when you have to replace the sound that was recorded in the field to kind of make it a more believable environment.
What does it sound like when a lioness is snuggling with her cub?
That's a good question. let me see my props I've got here.
Oh, yeah. So what are you doing right now?
Oh, that was my hand on a tissue on a piece of carpet.
Crafty. No, it's crafty, but it's also like tissue.
Yeah, doesn't take much.
So crafty or not, as somebody who works in audio, I find these sorts of tricks really fascinating. But where I do start to feel less comfortable is when sounds are created that don't actually exist. I watched a documentary that featured jellyfish, and one of the things that you hear every time they move, they sort of like, pulse forward, you'd hear this bloop.
Yeah. Like whooshing water.
Because if there's nothing there, as ironic as it sounds, even though a jellyfish probably isn't going to make a sound at all, if there's no sound there, it's less believable.
Frank said that he once had to create the sound of a crab walking on the beach, which he did by drumming pencils in a sandbox.
Let me get another pencil.
He tried to recreate the effect without the sandbox for us. Oh, yeah. I'm hearing a little crab.
It's close, but it's better with sand.
Yeah. I added a little sound effect here to really get the full effect. I'm convinced.
And, you know, the funny thing is, you know, you go to the beach, if you see a crab run across the beach, and you get the waves are so much louder, you're not going to hear the crab, you know. But when you got a close-up of a crab scurrying sideways across the beach, you want to hear it.
Do you ever feel like you're like, deceiving the audience at all?
No, not at all. Not with that type of stuff. It's really just kind of enhancing reality, you know, and trying to bring them into the environment.
So I'm on board with this. This to me doesn't feel like deception. This feels like making a better product.
But reality is reality. Like you can't make reality more real.
No. You're missing the point, which is that they're trying to bring you there. Right? So think like the Olympics.
Yeah.
They mic the Olympics in ways that enhance the viewer's experience. So they'll put microphones, like in gymnastics, they'll put microphones like in the pommel horse.
Oh yeah, you hear the sounds.
Yeah. Which like if you were at the Olympics, that's not what it would be like. If you were on the pommel horse, you would hear more like that. So it's like, whose reality are you experiencing? They're trying to bring you the reality that is the best viewing experience. And it's the same thing with this. It's like if you were that crab, like maybe the waves would be pretty loud, but you'd hear your feet. You'd hear your feet scuttling around.
I don't know. Maybe.
It might not sound quite like pencils in a sandbox. I think that a savvy listener or a savvy viewer understands that they're getting enhanced reality or they're getting some sort of enhancement to make a more entertaining experience.
I agree with you to a point, but when sound effects are done badly, I think they have the opposite effect. They take you out of the experience. And then, because you can tell something is fake, it calls into question everything about what you're watching. So even Planet Earth, which is like the gold standard of nature docs, they deal with this same problem. That Planet Earth iguana snake scene, for example, if you read the comments on the YouTube video, you start to see a lot of conspiracy theories. One commenter thinks they're using drones to get the shots. There's other people that think the whole thing is CGI. You know?
Planet Earth truthers.
Yeah. And I think that a lot of that has to do with the fact that by playing with the truth a little bit, you open the door sometimes to people who can't discern what you're saying into not knowing anything, and they call everything into question.
And the ridiculous-looking bird on the left is a puffin. Puffins have short wings, and they're glad of the sanctuary of the Farne Islands.
Okay, let's review. So we've got outright lemming murder / fake science. We've got fake whale narratives and emotional manipulation. And we've got the general use of fake sound effects and Foley.
So the last example of deception that we wanted to talk about is this show, Outside In. Because we've never killed lemmings, but we do use things like music and sound effects to try to enhance the listening experience.
Which got us wondering, what would a professional news editor, in this age of fake news and the struggle to maintain public trust, what would they say about our use of fake crab sounds or Misty the Whale-style narratives?
So we decided to ask our news director here at New Hampshire Public Radio, Dan Barrick, to listen to the story.
Before we get going, let me just test your mic. So Dan, give me a 1-2-1-2.
Okay. Sure, 1-2-1-2-1-2.
Okay.
Right off the bat, it was clear that Dan felt a little more violated by the sound manipulation than we do.
It was really disappointing to know that, like, I wasn't actually hearing that crab.
So you felt burned.
I felt really burned. Maybe I'll just watch them with the sound off now.
It was also pretty clear that Dan thinks the language we use to talk about these tricks is somewhat disingenuous.
One of the things that was interesting, too, is kind of like the hair splicing that some of those people would use to describe or justify this, you know, it's not that we're not deceiving, we're enhancing.
By some of those people, you mean me.
By you, and at first, like, you know, as a journalist, it's very easy for me to listen to those conversations and be like, no, that's what, you know.
But Dan also admits that the process of creating a news story is itself a construct.
The whole, you know, classic cliched structure of how you, you know, report a story is like, okay, let's get like an anecdotal lead. Let's find some guy or woman who represents the story and introduce them. And I mean, that itself is a structure that's meant to seem real and spontaneous. But in fact, you're crafting that and plucking away and adding on to.
Do you think that, I mean, we've been sort of going back and forth on what we think like our standard should be given these conversations. And I think that like disclosure is kind of something that we've settled on.
How what form would that take? Like at the end of each show, you just go through a litany of what?
It doesn't even have to be at the end. It could be right after. It could be right after you hear something.
I don't know. I think it's also like, who are you serving at that point? I mean, are listeners really feeling deceived in that? And I'm just talking specifically in your show, that you need to break the narrative flow of the piece to be like, hey, just want to let you know that sound you just heard actually was, you know, recreated in the studio. Or I don't know. It feels a little heavy-handed.
I'm thinking of one instance in particular in which we might wanna break the flow.
Yeah, yeah. Hold on. Let me just play a little clip here.
Check, check, check.
Okay, cool. So there's gonna be a couple funny questions that I ask you, Finn, that don't like really make any sense. Yeah. So we're gonna pretend that we're at a party at Sam's house.
Okay.
So can I have you say, thank you, Sam.
Thank you, Sam.
Oh, no.
Can I have you say, can I have some popcorn?
Can I have some popcorn?
You guys faked that whole party scene?
Yeah, so...
Oh my God.
How you feeling now?
Pretty low.
Like you want to stand up and punch me maybe?
So, in the spirit of full disclosure, here's how we did it.
Yeah, so... I started a Google Doc that said how to fake a party, and and I wrote instructions for everybody on it. And it started with you know, some sort of general sound elements.
Idle chatter, take two.
She keeps saying.
So we had some idle chatter here. We got some sound effects. Sam did the popcorn. So Taylor's gonna say, "I'll be Taylor," and then we'll be us.
Then we had producers pair up into groups and watch the iguana snake scene on their own.
Oh, no!
Go, guy, go!
This diversion, run for it!
But the headphones were on, so you didn't have the noise of the documentary polluting audio of us.
You guys are pretty sick. But why did you do that? You didn't even have to do that. You could have all just gotten around us. I think this changes our relationship.
Not to toot my own horn here, Sam, but I think this experiment with Dan really helped prove my earlier point, because once we told him the truth, he started to question everything.
The popcorn wasn't even real.
The popcorn was real popcorn. I just made it me and Aubrey at home by ourselves.
Okay. Was Aubrey in on it too?
Yeah. Oh,
oh
yeah.
Oh, my God.
Yeah, she seems very trustworthy.
Yeah. Did you guys actually hold Planet Earth parties in college?
Yes. Okay. That's right. True. Okay. And actually, we did it with the sound off. We would do it. Okay. So we watched.
So in case you're wondering, we have never staged a fake scene before on this show, but we have used sound effects from sound effect banks. And sometimes there are sections that are scripted that are designed to sound spontaneous.
You know, like little funny interjections, like this one.
By none other than Captain Picard,
who has a real name. He is an actor.
Yes.
This is all stuff that lots of other shows do, so maybe we don't need to disclose all the tricks that we have up our sleeves, but maybe we ought to. Because trust is hard to build, but it's very easy to lose.
Yeah. Yeah. I've never been taken. I'm trying to think of the last time I got. It's like, is this a real podcast even? Like.
Okay. I think that's it. Can we still be friends?
That's messed up. Jimmy was in there.
Coming up after a quick break, a 100% true story about a man and his donkey, Judas, and their years-long journey across South America together.
So we were walking and he just stopped. He just stopped in the middle of the trail and I was kind of annoyed and like, oye, burro, ¿qué le pasa? And like a couple seconds later, the path from above just washed out. There was like a landslide and I don't know what would happen to us.
No tricks, just a little music, and maybe just a tiny bit of emotional fascism. When Outside In continues.
All right, so you ready to watch a documentary?
Yeah.
Okay, excited?
Yeah.
This is Outside In, a show about the natural world and how we use it. So today we heard about the various ways that nature documentaries manipulate audiences. Some of those ways are clearly unethical. Others involve fancy editing tricks. But sometimes a good storyteller doesn't need much to keep his listeners hooked. This next piece is a good example of a straight-up, no-frills, good story. And it comes to us from our friends at Human Nature, another cool show about how people interact with the natural world. And here's the host, Caroline Ballard.
More than a decade ago, John Dunham packed up some books, some food, and a tent, and began walking south from Oregon. He wanted to make his world bigger. For a year, he walked through the western U.S., finally arriving in Texas. And when he got there, it was decision time. Should he do as he'd always wanted and continue south, even though he didn't speak Spanish? He thought, why not? And kept walking into arid northern Mexico.
It was really a difficult experience, really isolating experience, more so even than just walking in the United States, because I was unable to communicate with the people, which was something I really valued when I was walking in the States, the people I'd meet, the ideas that we would share. That was really something important to me. It was even worse because you didn't know what they were saying about you.
But when John walked into a tiny village, everything about his isolation changed. As he walked down the main street, he met a family who offered him breakfast.
Just through the few words in English that some of them knew and my dictionary, we just started to communicate, and they invited me to stay the night, and then the son invited me to work with the cows, and like, well, you have to stay for the wedding.
Their daughter's wedding. And after the wedding, the family sort of adopted him, and he stayed with them for a year.
I started to learn to milk cows, which is very difficult if you don't have someone to explain to you how to do it. You just kind of have to learn from ground zero. Started to learn the language, started to learn the culture, their values, the way they thought, the way they worked, the way they lived, which was all new to me, so it was very interesting. And when the year was up, when a year had passed, I told them that I wanted to continue on whatever it was I was doing. I wanted to continue my walk, I guess. And the grandfather came to me one day, and he gave me a pair of boots and a pair of pants, and he gave me a donkey. Which was kind of terrifying at the time because, how do you take care of a donkey? Like, what does a donkey eat? How much does it drink? How much can it carry? How far can it walk? Does it need horseshoes? Like, do you need to deworm it? Do you need to get vaccinations? Like, there's an endless list of things that I had questions to and no answers. And my friends are like, don't worry about it, it'll be fine.
Why did he give you a donkey?
Well, because I was walking when I came to the inn, you know, I had a backpack, so the backpack is really heavy. It was so much deeper and so much rich a gift than I could have imagined at that time. Because what the donkey really did for me is he created kind of a bridge between me and the people.
Before the donkey, not a lot of people came up to John to talk to him. But now they did, because even in rural parts of Latin America, it's not every day you see someone walking with a donkey.
When I had the donkey, people were much more willing to come close to me and talk to me and ask me questions, and I met just tons and tons of people.
What did you name the donkey?
His name was Judas in Spanish with us, although in English I'd call him Jude, but I mostly just spoke to him in Spanish, so I'd call him Judas.
What? Why that name? Why'd you name him Judas?
Well, there's lots of reasons. I kind of like the name because whenever I told people his name was Judas, they would immediately associate it with the traitor. In the Bible, one of the other apostles was also named Judas. You don't really ever hear about him, but he did exist. And in the Catholic Church, he's a saint, and he's a saint of lost causes, which I kind of identified with. It was interesting how he interacted with people. Like, I stopped trusting my ability to make judgments of people. Like, I would meet people and I'd be like, wow, this guy's so cool, I really like him. And then I'd find out, you know, he was like a sicario, he was like an assassin for hire. And then I'd meet other people like, this person is so annoying, he's a dork, I don't like him, I don't like being with him. And he ended up being like one of my most faithful friends. But Judas would, he would get, sometimes with some people, he'd get really nervous. Like, you know, he'd put his head down and he'd like be really fidgety and he'd be like pushing on me. And I realized that he was not comfortable in the situation, which made me uncomfortable, which made me want to just move on, say, well, it's really nice to meet you, but I need to try to go a little further today. And other times we meet people and he'd be totally calm, like he would be at peace, which would also make me feel more at ease.
For a year, John and Judas made their way through Central America. But continuing on to South America wasn't so easy. For starters, there's no road connecting the continents.
Like you can't get to South America by road. There's no road. Even though if you look at the map, you can see that Panama is connected with Colombia and South America. It's like a totally undeveloped region.
It's dense jungle. And John says everything there is trying to kill you. If it's not the snakes trying to bite you, it's the rebel army, FARC, trying to kidnap you.
And then if I did happen to get past the jungle and the FARC, then the Colombian government would put me in jail for entering the country illegally, and they would sacrifice my donkey for also entering illegally. So I couldn't think of any good reason to go into this area. So the only way around it is mostly by airplane, but it's kind of hard to stick a donkey on an airplane. So my only real option was to try to find a boat. But there's no passenger boats. There's no tourist boats. There's only cargo boats. So you go down to the docks and you're asking the captains, they're like, are you a sailor? It took a long time and it was really complicated, but eventually I found a boat that was willing to take me and Judas to Colombia.
But when John and Judas got to Colombia, border officials there wouldn't accept the papers for Judas that Panama had issued.
So they said, this donkey, he can't come into our country. You have to go back to Panama and do all the paperwork there again and then come back. And it was like, you don't know how hard it was to get on this boat. And it kind of became a little bit of an international incident because Colombia wasn't accepting the sanitation papers of Panama, and they saw it as a breach of their autonomy, and it kind of blew up. There was lots of like press, like all the national broadcasting companies like came and interviewed me. Eventually, Colombia just dug in their heels and they said, no, we're not letting this donkey in. They wouldn't even let him off the boat in the docks to be able to eat. I had to cut all the grass and bring it onto the boat. Eventually, the boat just had to leave.
For Venezuela. So that's where John and Judas had to go.
Venezuela was the last place on the planet, probably, that I wanted to go to.
At the time, the communist dictator Hugo Chavez was president of Venezuela. He didn't get along with then-president George W. Bush. Tension between the countries got so high that Chavez kicked the whole American embassy out of Venezuela. The Venezuelan government watched American visitors suspiciously and sometimes held them against their will. So John had no desire to get in the middle of all of that.
But that's where I had to go because it was either abandon my donkey or my friend at this point or continue on to Venezuela.
So yeah, I mean, I'm thinking about you literally cutting the grass to bring to your donkey. I mean, that's a special bond.
It was a lot of work. It's tiring.
John and Judas spent about a year in Venezuela waiting to get into neighboring Colombia. While he worked through all the red tape, John tried to avoid the Venezuelan government, which viewed him as a spy, and also tried to keep Judas safe in the Caracas slum where they lived.
I was working in horse stables because that was the only work that I could get, and it was a good place for him because he was in an environment where, you know, horses were safe. But I would leave him in the back of the horse stables in the day so that he could eat, and then at night I would bring him into the horse stables, and everybody in the neighborhood knew me. There are these things called invasions. I don't really know how you call them what you call them in English, but it's when it's like squatting. So if somebody squats on a land, here in the States you have to squat for like, I don't know, 7 or 8 years in order for the land to become yours. There you squat for 1 hour and it's yours. And basically it was Chavez wanted to kind of destabilize the landowners. So one way that he could destabilize some of the landowners, the rich landowners, was to allow these invasions, these squatters. And so they weren't always the best of people. And so like there was a huge invasion behind the stables where I was at. Like a couple hundred people came in and just took over a huge field and started living there. So, you know, if a person's willing to steal land, they're definitely willing to steal a donkey.
And then one day, Judas disappeared.
I mean, when I first saw that he wasn't there, it was horrible. I mean, I felt like, I can't even describe it. I mean, I felt like, what if I lose him? What if I never see him again? Because they would kill him and they would mix his meat with cow meat and they'd sell it cheap in the market. So there was a real possibility that I would never find him. And one neighbor was a child kidnapper, that's what they did, and the other neighbor was an assassin. Like, there was really no law at the time. Just whatever money was the law, basically. So it was terrifying.
But John had to get Judas back, so he snuck into the squatter's camp.
I had to get my friend back, so he was tied up, obviously. Like, I could just whistle and he would come. He knew my whistle, he knew my voice, and he would come to me. But since he was tied up, he couldn't come to me, but he would bray. So I knew where he was at, and so I went in like at midnight and I stole him back. And I found him, he was just standing there waiting for me. And we walked out, we didn't see a single person. So I was really thankful for that. I was much more careful with him after that.
Finally, after months of paperwork, John and Judas were allowed to pass through Colombia and continue on their journey into the high trails of Ecuador and on to Peru.
And these high trails can be dangerous because they're quite thin, skinny and quite thin, and then just the drop-off is just, you know, miles down to the creek bed. So they can be quite dangerous, especially during the rainy season, because the dirt and the rocks, they tend to loosen because of the rain. So we were walking, and he just stopped. He just stopped in the middle of the trail, and I was kind of annoyed and, like, you know, probably yelling at him. I don't remember, like, why are you stopping? Oye, burro, ¿qué le pasa? So he just stopped, and I'm like, what are you doing? What's going on? And, like, a couple seconds later, the path from above just washed out. There was, like, a landslide, and I don't know what would happen to us. Well, he wouldn't have been in there, but if I had been in the middle of that, it could have been very dangerous. And Peru is just, like, gorgeous. I mean, it's unbelievable. The Andes are unbelievable. They're so high, and real, like, rugged beauty. I really love Peru. There's all sorts of trails, just like single track trails that go across Peru. There's a set of trails which are the Inca trails, the old Inca highways that the Inca Empire built when they were in control of Peru. And so following those all the way across Peru was one of the neatest experiences, something I never could have done alone. It was so much more enjoyable and interesting with Judas to come with me.
Soon, John and Judas entered the Chaco, a savanna region spanning parts of Paraguay and Bolivia. In the Chaco, towns are hundreds of miles apart, with not much in between, except lots and lots of jaguars.
The people would tell me, you can't go out there. There's jaguar, and the jaguar will kill you and eat you in night, and they're really, really aggressive. The few ranchers that live out there, they would always have guns with them. They would never not have guns with them. When we went out into the Chaco, I was a little bit nervous, but I also knew a little bit about how donkeys are. And what would happen in the night time when I was sleeping, the jaguar would approach our camp and my donkey, Judas, would just go crazy. He would just start running and jumping and kicking and really dramatic movements. I don't know if you've ever seen a wild horse. Like, you don't really want to approach it. So this is what he did. And I didn't really know what was going on at the time, but basically the jaguar was approaching and Judas was saying, if you come any closer, you're going to have to deal with me, basically. But the jaguar would several times approach in the night, and he would basically chase him off. So I felt like if I had tried to do that by myself, maybe I wouldn't be here right now. I feel like he saved my life in those instances.
Did you ever see him as, like, a guardian angel?
Lots of people did. I don't know. I never really viewed him in that spiritual sense, although I wouldn't say that that would be impossible. I did see him as someone who protected me in many situations. At one point in Brazil, he was bitten by a snake, and people would always say that there was a good chance that if it hadn't bitten him, maybe it would have bitten me. His head fell, his tongue came out. He just looked like he was, like he was drunk, he started to sway, he fell. I stayed up with him all night. I thought that he was gonna die at any moment, I thought I was gonna lose him. But donkeys are really tough, and in the morning, he got up, He didn't recognize me. I thought maybe something had happened to his eyesight. Although in retrospect, I think maybe something happened to his ability to smell, because that's one way he would identify me, with my voice mainly and with my smell. It took him a while to kind of recover from that. It was an incredible shock. The people told me any horse would have died for sure, and that I would have died too if I'd been bitten by that snake. So he survived, and we stopped for about a month, and it seemed to me that he had recovered completely, and we started walking again.
At this point, John and Judas had been walking together for about 5 years, across Mexico, Central America, and nearly all the countries in South America. Judas had never acted confused, but now, after the snake bite, he seemed different. John says Judas seemed less confident than usual about which plants were safe or good to eat.
And when we got into southern Brazil, this was like 3 or 4 months after Judas had been bitten by the snake, he got real sick one night. It wasn't the first time that he had been sick, but in the morning, he wasn't there. I would just leave him loose at night so he could eat whatever he wanted, and then he would usually eat and then come back and stand guard by my tent. But this night, he walked past a house a couple kilometers down the road, and the dog started barking, so the owner came out, and he had seen me pass the evening before, so he knew it was my donkey, and he thought, oh, he just escaped, so I'll tie him up. And in the morning, he wasn't there. I was whistling, and he wasn't coming, and so I followed his tracks to the house, and it was only, he was basically just waiting for me. When I got there, he brayed really loud and pushed up against me, and about 15 minutes later, he fell, and then it wasn't much longer before he died. And when he died, I mean, I just ran into the woods and just sat down and cried. I didn't know. It was a really, really emotional time for me. And I didn't know. I couldn't even believe it. I just couldn't believe it. I just kept saying, how, why? It was really traumatic for me. And it took me a long time to kind of regather myself after that. So I took him, and I took him back to the point where we had reached walking, the last point that he had walked, and which took most of the day because donkeys are really heavy. And I dug a hole, and I worked all night, and it took all night. And about noon the next day, I had him buried. And I just spent about a month right there in that spot. I was about 20 miles from town, and the people were super nice. People would always, they would come out and they'd bring me food and they would try to encourage me, and people would offer me another animal. And I just kind of sat there and just thought and decided what was next. And I built him like a little gravestone, and that was my way of saying goodbye to him. Donkeys can live to 30 or even 40 years, so I felt like we should be dying together. Like, he should have been with me the rest of my life.
But John wanted to finish what he and Judas had started. So he decided to keep going to the tip of South America.
And the people in the little village, they bought me a backpack, and I had to put all my stuff in there. And now I'm the donkey. I'm the one that has to carry all the weight. And it was really hard walking away from his gravesite, though. For me, that was kind of the end of that journey, because he had opened up so many possibilities for me, so many doors. And when I was walking alone, all those doors were closed. Like, people didn't approach me, people didn't talk to me. It was much more isolating.
Would you ever go back to visit that site, his gravesite?
I did. When I came back on my motorcycle, I was able to go by the same place and meet the people that helped me while I was there. And I stayed about a month there visiting with all the people from that little town and the little ranch that was next to his grave. And the people are awesome. Like, they would always go out and, like, kind of take care of his gravesite. And, like, the road crews would always clean around his gravesite, which was further off the road than they would normally clean. So, like, it was well taken care of. And it was really... It wasn't a sad time to go back and see his grave. It was really a happy time. It was really a blessing to be able to meet with those people again and to see his grave and just to remember all the things that I got to experience because of him.
That was John Dunham. Human Nature is hosted by Caroline Ballard and produced by Micah Schweitzer. Outside In is produced by Maureen McMurray, Taylor Quimby, Logan Shannon, Molly Donahue, Jimmy Gutierrez, and me, Sam Evans-Brown. Special thanks to Phineas Quimby and Dan Barrick this week for being participants in our experiment in radio deception. Also thanks to Cynthia Chris and to Elizabeth White. She and the rest of the folks at Planet Earth have actually put out some behind-the-scenes footage of how they made the iguana snake scene that we referenced earlier in the show, and they've been really candid about their practices in case you want to learn more about how they do it. Our theme is by Breakmaster Cylinder, additional music by Mon Plaisir. I'm Sam Evans-Brown. Outside In is a production of New Hampshire Public Radio.
We wanted, in that same film, we wanted a picture of an orca skull on the sea floor. And we knew that would be very hard to find, and our budget's limited, as it always is when you're making films. And so we got a skull. We borrowed a skull from a scientist and put it on the floor of the sea and filmed it. We pretended it was there all the time, it was completely natural, but we ourselves put it there. Again, is that acceptable? Not. We did it, as you pointed out, we did it because we wanted to create a narrative, a story, but we deceived the audience. We did something, we didn't tell them what we'd done.